Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Daniel Quick.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
Cardamandua.
With guest co-hosts...
Nolan.
Pinchak. Okay, then.
Mackie?
Mm?
Anna Lee?
Hello.
Christopher?
Hello.
Imran?
Hi.
And Daniel?
Yes, you do.
And I'm known as Nolan in the civic area of gaming.
And Condor223 on Poly.
Yes.
Imran, I haven't talked to you in a long time.
I know.
That was a pretty good run staying away from you.
Can you believe this goes on in, during games, too, when we get together?
In forum talk, roleplay, your thoughts on the Janissary, catches, and is there a way to exclude leaders?
In the Senate, we discuss too much money, surviving a jungle start, we fear you are becoming too advanced, and the pyramids, the great debate of cost versus production.
From the vault, most vassals on a single turn, and top 100 game designers.
In theater, we talked about our gameplay experience.
This is Forum Talk, where we investigate hot civ issues in the forums.
Roleplay. Yes, I do. I play quite a few multiplayer games in the diplomacy games. You have to roleplay there. You write stories, and a lot of the business is based on that.
Yeah, Stony the First had said that when I play Civ on my comfort difficulty level, which I don't think he actually defined, but that's all right, I always intend to roleplay a bit, such as setting my own goals besides winning the game, going for some historical accuracy, before starting the game, setting a goal with the leader you pick. I do this occasionally to increase the fun factor in Civ to make it feel more epic in a way. Also, it adds a personal touch, quote-unquote. And I would say, with the poll entries there, I think I'm under... Not the first one where I completely roleplay all of my games. I think I'm under the majority category where I sometimes make decisions based on roleplaying a bit, but not when it can be game-breaking. Always trying to keep the end goal in mind.
Well, I think everybody has their own style of play, which, you know, depends on single player, multiplayer, and your various purposes of play. There are league folks, and they don't roleplay other than in killer mode. I like to go for a religion that's historically connected with the history of the civ I choose, if I get a choice. And I also have done the diplomacy games. And then, you know, some folks play the scenarios, which involves an outlook of a particular historical era.
You mentioned if some people are just in killer mode. Well, you can roleplay a bit there. But kill fast or slow today? Heeny, meeny, miny, mo.
It's all in quick. 3 hours and we'll all get you.
I don't know if you guys are aware, but the Diplo games that they play on Apolyton, I play in them quite often, actually focuses on roleplay, and it kind of tries to downplay the winning aspect. Personally, though, I usually play to win.
Yeah, I find it to be more fun that way. Now, if it looks like I'm going to lose, or I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose, I think we've discussed before on the show, like, if it looks like you're going to die, do you keep on playing until you die? And the answer is, no, I don't. But if I'm getting behind the eight ball, I will try to get back into it. But yeah, generally I prefer to play to win. It's more fun that way for some reason.
I probably role play a little bit more if it's single player. Because if I lose, who cares? No one saw it.
Yeah. This thread started by Civ4 Monger. He thinks the Janissary is a multi-purpose unit, good versus everything but cannons. Also, unlike its musketman counterpart, which it replaces, it is good at offense. It definitely ranks up there on my top 5 unique units. And after I read that, I thought, oh yeah, we actually ranked, or I guess more specifically, I ranked top 10 unique units in episode 42 from last year. The Janissary wasn't on the list. But still, the Janissary, 9 strength, as I said before, it replaces the musketmen that's for the Ottoman Empire, plus 25% versus archery, melee, and mounted units. I think, just like with the musketmen, it's the limited window for the usefulness of the Janissary that kept it from making my top 10 list. And so again, I wouldn't say it's a horrible unique unit. I wouldn't put it in a top 10, though. If I happen to be playing the Ottomans, of course I'm going to use it. But do I go out of my way to play the Ottomans to use it?
No. I agree. But then I tend to play either of the Indias, Montezuma, or any of the Egyptians more often, so I normally don't get to see the Janissaries unless it's on the other end of the stick.
Some people in here argue that, also with the short window kind of thing, just go a few more technologies and get riflemen. And the argument was made by UW Habs that, remember that rifles cost more, and with Janissaries you can ignore rifling. Well, that's true. I think that spending the time to go to rifling, the investment in the technology for rifling, as well as the fact that the rifles cost more hammers, is well worth it. Particularly if you have, say, some macemen that you've accumulated, and they've got some city raider promotions, and then you can upgrade them to the rifles. But really, Janissary, just one of those kind of narrow window, mid to late-ish kind of gamed units, which most of my top 10 units were from the beginning to kind of the middle periods of the game besides.
I think one thing we should note is Janissary comes at a time in the game when usually things are heating up. Players that are bent on warmongering will generally build a lot of medieval units, and they'll have their stacks. And players that are in a defensive position will try to get to musketmen to fend that off. So although it does have a limited window of opportunity there, it comes at a good time in the game.
I think for someone like me who always liked the mounted unit lines, particularly knights and cuirassiers and then ultimately cavalry, the Janissaries plus 25% against mounted units does make it in that window that it can be useful, particularly if it's got further promotions along the line. Can be very helpful, along with some defensive promotions, say, inside of cities to ward off the mounted fray. Digital Boy notes that Janissaries are the next best thing behind a pikeman to fight knights with, and they clean up everything else nicely, too. Obviously, superb unit if you can find the opportunity to use them. For some of the other unique units I have on the list, I think you're more likely to encounter the situations that they're beneficial for. But of course, it is a lot of personal preference. But still, at the same time, I don't think a Janissary is any kind of top unique unit material. Every unique unit is situational. I just think that there are other unique units out there that have more common and more immediate situations that give it preference over the Janissary.
Well, it takes a certain amount of time to turns to make them. So how many could you make in the short window of opportunity to find them really effective?
If you were playing on, say, Marathon or Epic Speed, where the ages are drawn out a little more, perhaps the Janissary's usefulness, just like with any unit, say even the medieval units, time is extended. So I will give them that consideration. There's actually a side debate in this thread comparing the Janissaries to Ethiopia's Ormo warriors, and specifically with the Ormo warriors, building them and then upgrading them along the technology path and which one ends up being better. And interestingly enough, the Ormo warrior was number 10 on my top 10 list. The Aftershafter had said that Jans are a better all-round unit if you can get them first, hands down. They have everything covered, no weakness against knights, and no need to waste upgrade slots to specifically target unit types. What's more, if you make a formation Jan, it would slaughter knights wholesale. Same deal for cover and shock Jans, of course referring to the cover and shock promotions. I'd pick Ormos over the long term, and I'd find them preferable in more games, but if my plan is to wage a gunpowder war, then go into peace mode for a stretch, I might favor Jans. I think that's a fair assessment. I'm not usually a gunpowder war person, unless it happens to be a little later on when I can get cavalry. Well, I guess Kirasur is kind of too, but more so cavalry.
Well, talking about windows of opportunity, the Quechuas also have a narrow window, which is probably early game and not so great on large maps.
Oh, it's a four-monger again.
Yeah.
Who obviously is not trying to catch a rush.
As Gloria was saying, I completely agree with it. I had him on my top 10 list. In fact, it was number 3. Catches being 2 strength, the unique unit for Inca replacing the warrior, plus 25% city defense, and what I think is its hollow point, plus 100% versus archery units. But Civ 4 Monger goes so far to say as they suck. Sure, they look appealing, but when the AI gets bronze, they get axes. Quechua cannot stand up to axes, even with the axe stack defender. It's useless. Quechuas aren't very good, quote-unquote. And after I read that, I thought, I feel a migraine coming on. let's piece this bit by bit here. Sure, they look appealing, but when the AI gets bronze, they get axes. So this is where they come in handy to help deny the AI copper. Now, it's true if you're playing on larger maps or it happens to be particular AIs are some distance away, unless you are spending your workers to build a ridiculous cross-continental road network, which they would be better off doing something else almost surely, then yes, that's going to be a problem. But if you have close neighbors, as was discussed in the thread, you can use them for an early rush, or you can situate them near, for instance, if you find out your opponents will have copper, then you can have them nearby so they can go in and get rid of that copper and either be part of the rush or have other units yourself to move in so you don't have to spend, you know, your axemen or your swordsmen a turn pillaging that. You can have your Quechua doing that. And as long as they're defended with some other units, they'll probably survive and you'll be able to make that pillage. The other thing that Quechuas are very beneficial for is against barbarian units, particularly on the higher levels where they are getting archers from the beginning. Archer units are pains in the butt when they are defending cities, but when they are roaming around, nom nom. They are sitting targets, and they are great for picking off early archers and warriors. With those early promotions that they can get from picking off those and being able to upgrade them along the line, excellent. Excellent axemen, macemen.
Just like the Janissary, one thing I'll say about this unit is what makes it good is when it comes into play. And usually I find the earlier in the game your unique unit appears, the more valuable it is. Just kind of a broad statement. So them appearing right off the bat, I mean, you have that instant advantage very early in the game when a lot of things are decided.
Exactly. And even if you can't go after a nearby AI's capital, if they decide to expand a little bit, of course, if they expand a little bit, they're going to be defending with warriors or archers. If you have enough of them, you build them up. Once you find them, you can use them to monitor where the AI is going and or go in and get rid of their second or maybe their second city, so to speak, and cripple them. And you can hold them off and use them to pillage any of those resources, again, copper or even, say, horse, to prevent them from being able to build up. And then when you are able to get into axemen and swordsmen, you can go in and finish the job. Sydhe, something that I hadn't thought of specifically before, which is Quechuas are pretty good explorers. And of course, scouts for their speed and their early availability are beneficial, but of course, they're usually breakfast for barbarians at some point, particularly on the higher difficulty levels with the animals. I always like it, actually, to take a warrior to explore early on, hopefully get it some early combat wins, and then be able to get it to Woodsman 2, so then it can move double speed through forest and have a better chance of surviving till at least a little later on. So being able to do that with Quechuas, that's actually another good benefit for them. And besides, Quechuas start with the letter Q, so how can you not love them? All right, I should have said that from the beginning. Is there a way to exclude leaders, asks Sivir. I don't want to hand-select all my opponents, but there's a few leaders I hate playing against. Mansa is one that comes to mind right now. I was wondering if you can set up a game to play random AIs, but exclude some without entering World Builder to check your opponents. It can be annoying to hand-select your opponents if they're people you want to exclude. It would be nice to see the option, but I don't think it's particularly critical.
It says you. I'm tired of seeing Montezuma make him go away.
Well, that's the thing, though. When you hit random, it's not really that random. some of the leaders have a higher tendency of showing up than others. There are some leaders I almost never play against if I had only done random. You know? And some, like Montezuma, you get a lot.
Japan. Computer loves Japan.
I find quite a bit of the aggressive leaders showing up with my random selections, and it drives me crazy. I would like to be able to, in the game setup, choose no aggressive, at least while I'm learning a new difficulty level.
I mean, in addition to hand-selecting the leaders, you could choose a leader, and it wouldn't necessarily have to be the leader you didn't like. If the Civ had more than one leader, and it was the other leader you didn't like to see in the game, but you would not want to play him or her, you could play the other one, and then it wouldn't appear. You could do that as well.
But then it's not a surprise. It's half the fun.
Well, one way to prohibit your unfavorite opponent is to be it. Choose to be the difficult one.
If you're really wanting to exclude someone, you can. It requires going into the XML and the Customs Asset folder, the leader head, and you can disable whatever leaders you don't like. While I think it's better to learn how to deal with all of them, I think if you really feel that strongly, it's not so bad to go in and change the XML. As I said, it would be nice to have that option, maybe for Civ 5, although I think they could probably include that in a patch if they wanted to do another patch, add that option. I think if it's as simple as going into the XML yourself manually, then having that somehow change through the game options shouldn't be that difficult. But short of that, there is that way.
They just need to improve their random generator.
The only one I can't stand to see is Americans. I wish there was a way to exclude the Americans appearing in 4000 BC. All the other ones, I kind of look at it as, I selected random, so this is what came up in the toss, but definitely could be a better random generator as well.
Or if there was a way to select in, say, random ancient era civs.
That would be handy.
Or have the selection queued down to the UUs for, say, if you are going to start in the classical era, to find that all the random civs are those with UUs in that era. It'd be fun to whack it at something that's able to kick back.
That sounds like an assignment for the modcast people.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
Too much money.
Seems like an oxymoron in real life, but in the game, actually, it can be a problem. For the past couple of games, an interesting thing has happened to me. I have a ton of money. Last game I played on Noble, still a rookie, remember, and I had 6,800 gold and about 70 gold income per turn by 900 AD, quote-unquote. I'll stop right there. I'm not so concerned about the 70 gold per turn, but having this 6,800 in the bank, wow. Anyways, continuing, and I have no clue what to spend it on. Most other civs hate me, so I couldn't trade money for research with them, although I was by far the most advanced civ RE research, and there is only so much construction you can rush. What exactly do you do with your cash? What have I missed? Quote, unquote.
Gotta turn up your difficulty level.
Gracious, you can upgrade your army, or if you've built the pyramids, go buy your buildings.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that works out to 20-some-odd tanks you could rush by.
Yeah, that's what I do with most of my gold income, and I don't let it accumulate that much before I start spending.
I don't get it. I'm generally tight on mine.
Well, he did say he was still on Noble at the moment, so...
I'm skeptical myself.
Or he cashed in a couple of great merchants.
That's possible.
Or he had a couple of wonders he didn't quite get to.
One turn away. Cha-ching.
I think the other thing besides, and as was pointed out in the thread, in addition to upgrading your units, deficit spending for science.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he does say he's the most advanced Civ RE research, so again, back to what Chris was saying, maybe you need to be upping your difficulty level then.
Yeah.
Especially as you go up on the higher difficulty levels, unless you want to get destroyed. You need to stay on top of tech, but you've got a lot of other expenses going on there. Well, being able to run a deficit takes a little bit of micromanagement to be fully effective on it, but that's something else you could be doing. It is possible in a later game, if you're going for some wonders and you're really close and you've had some great merchants like Mackie mentioned, maybe in a turn or something you can find yourself with several thousand gold pieces, but if you still have this and you're accumulating this turn after turn after turn, you are missing something.
And saying, hey, AI, threaten me for money.
Yeah, that's the other thing. I suppose if you're not particularly powerful militaristically, you could either gift the AI some gold, particularly aggressive ones, to be a little happier towards you, or you'd be able to give in to those demands for fear of being wiped off the map. I suppose there is that benefit.
You need to build more cities.
Yeah, that too. Expand.
Or you get capture more cities. That's always yep. Takes up your gold.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the demographics graph for the game he's talking about. See where he is as far as gold production. Because making that much gold can't be producing a whole lot.
Hmm.
Mostly cottages, I would imagine.
Yeah, that would help with some additional context here.
He started playing a week ago, and, you know, he's already doing the One City Challenge. Man!
How would you survive a jungle start? Say if you were going to have a short game, or, say, start in the ancient era.
Well, I mean, ironworking should always be a priority. Not the first priority, necessarily, but always a priority, particularly if you want for copper and horse. But if you've got a jungle start, then I'd be prioritizing that a little bit sooner, so then you can chop those. The first reply to this thread from NIMBY was by X Chen, where I mod my game so that jungle provides 20 hammers when cut down. Okay, excluding mods, thank you.
I don't mind jungle start. The whole thing about it, the key is to survive until you get into a later part in the game, because basically you'll have a lot of grassland, won't be hard up for food. Also, some of the more hard-to-come-by resources, they're usually clumped together, so you can trade those for other resources. It's just, it's a hard start, but if you can survive it, it's definitely an advantage, I think, in the long run.
The slow start, iron working, chances are you're not going to be growing that fast anyway, so you only have to chop two or three tiles to get something happening.
Yeah, think about the potential of the jungle underneath with being grassland. Great places for cottages. And it's also possible that if you've got lots of jungle and you're not seeing hills anywhere nearby, in terms of production, you could very well find that you have, hey, there's a grassland iron, and there's where my hammer production could be.
Or you farm it, and you go workshop.
Ah, yes, prioritize metal casting afterwards to be able to do that as well. Yep.
You can also, usually, if you're in jungle, there's jungle everywhere, you can set up some pretty interesting defenses where basically your units sit in the jungle, you make some clearings, make a point in there where the AI has to jump into a clearing to get to you. That's where you can decimate them. It's a different start. It's not as easy as a normal start, but there's advantages to it, just like everything in Civ.
I certainly would like to get rid of any jungle tile that's touching my cities. I usually chop down all the trees around my cities, you know, to give a visitor a poor chance for hiding and strength.
Yeah, that and nearby your cities that can be a health problem.
Yeah, I think they answer the question here in a word, surviving a jungle start, workers. You need to go heavy workers early and basically clear it out. It's kind of a no-brainer, but you'd be surprised how many people neglect workers even without jungle around.
And hopefully with jungle start, you increase the likelihood that you've got some resources for plantations, so calendar, and also gems. Gems.
You know, the Haga Sophia, a good wonder to get if you're dealing with a lot of jungle. Also, go serfdom early. Try to increase your workers' production.
Oh, yeah. It's like give you plus 50% worker speed or something?
Yeah, both of them. Although I forget what the tech is that nullifies a Sophia. But actually, I was playing a pit boss game a couple months ago where I had nothing but jungle forever. And very early on, I made the decision that I had to make serfdom and the Haga priorities. And I ended up getting the Haga and going serfdom, and it definitely helped. In the long run, I had no problem dealing with the jungle start. Did pretty good in the game.
Yeah, Haga Sophia comes with theology and expires with steam power. We fear that you are becoming too advanced. Owen Glindire says, out of the blue, so-and-so hit the WFYBTA limit, or we fear you're becoming too advanced at friendly relations. This is the first time I've hit that threshold, as in my past games, I dominated to such an extent that there was no one really to trade with. So once this hits, that's it, right? No more trading with Civ. What do you guys do? about WFYBTA? Do you have to just pick and choose the text you trade for? Also, I was under the impression that it does not apply if friendly. Is that not true? And as RJM notes that friendly says we'll continue to trade, but they are picky. I often avoid accepting tech I don't want when offered as part of what would make this deal work to delay that. And I expect to out-tech them anyway in the later game. And I think the most important thing there is to trade only for the technologies that you really want, that you really need, so that way you limit hitting that threshold, which is not something I'd considered before, actually. There's a good thread that's linked to, and this thread started by Voice of Unreason, where he talks about the mechanics of technology trading limits, where your potential trading partner will shun you when both of these conditions are met. You or your trading partner are in the top half of the scoreboard, including no longer around civs, and the number of technologies that your trading partner remembers that you have received from someone else exceeds the no tech trading threshold of this trading partner. And so it's that remembers part that's a random element. The memory decay is a random element. So you can predict when you are going to hit the limit, but you cannot easily predict when the restriction is going to be lifted, which is all the more reason why to be able to monitor when you're going to hit the limit and who you're going to be hitting the limit with. You do not want to annoy those more powerful and particularly more aggressive AIs that can get to you. The thread notes that it does vary by leader, and it's referenced in there. Those that hit it at 5 techs, 10 techs, and so on. The value is modified by the difficulty level handicap. It's 100% boost on Settler and only a 20% boost on Deity in terms of the number of techs.
Well, I think it's time for the player to up his difficulty level.
Yep, you can do that. You can also, in the game setup, make it so that you cannot trade technologies or broker technologies. So then this wouldn't apply at all. So as long as you are not playing with those options enabled, then this is something to be paying attention to. And you can also see through the relations screen who so-and-so is the worst enemy of. If you're trying to decide who you want to trade with, and you want to keep this person happy, not to trade with this other person, even if that other person happens to have the technologies you want, decide, okay, this is going to increase my getting to that threshold. Is it worth it? Because I don't know when that memory of that trade is going to start to decay.
Yes.
Wow, I covered that topic so thoroughly. Everyone is just in awe and amazement and reverence and all these wonderful good things.
Well, how about...
I was wondering how long I'd have to use these adjectives before I get a reaction.
Sorry, Dan, I fell asleep during the monologue.
Well, what about the pyramids? I was surprised to have found that the AI did not build the pyramids, and we were in the mid-game, weren't we, Dan?
Yeah, we were. I figured, you know, if the AI didn't build it, then the aliens would have. But they hadn't either, so you might as well have gone ahead. So, yeah, the pyramids, the great debate of cost versus production. And then this thread started by M. Bodicher. So, yeah, pyramids. 500 cost requires masonry, which enables all government civics and does not expire. Yeah, it's the cost that's really the crux here. When you consider the other available wonders at the time, such as Stonehenge at 120 hammers or the Oracle and the Great Wall at 150 hammers and what the benefits can bring. I will say with pyramids, if you don't have stone, why? Unless you're paying on a lower difficulty level or at least a lower difficulty level for you. Maybe if you're in an isolated start and you've determined it's an isolated start. But another reason that I argue against not building the pyramids, and this is not something that I had, quote-unquote, against the pyramids when I was in the earlier difficulty levels, which was also on the cost, but the benefit to me of the pyramids, yeah, there's the great engineer people points, but, I mean, the enabling all government civics, the actual direct benefit of the pyramids, I much prefer hereditary rule for a lot of the game because it increases your happiness cap with the military presence. Of course, going into representation, that's great for the science, except then I get lots of angry faces, and then I'm not able to run as much science anyway, and I've spent all that time building it, and it just makes me a nicer target for an AI to go after because they know I've got a new shiny. So,
If I'm Egypt, I build the pyramids on a matter of principle. However, I think as often as not, they never get built in my games at all, because if I don't build them, the AI doesn't build them.
I don't buy the argument that this person's putting forth about foregoing heretic rule. If you're a philosophical civ or an industrial civ, and you think you can build them before someone else, I think it's definitely worth it for representation. Well, if you're philosophical, for representation. If you're industrial and you have the stone, I think it's a no-brainer. Build them. But when I play a philosophical civ, I usually try to find a way to build the pyramids, to go for that early representation. Generally, I don't rely on a heretic rule for my happiness. I'll build buildings or acquire resources. So, I mean, it's in how you play. For me, the early representation, usually, if I can get it, my science is way above most of my opponents.
Certainly, I'd rather the buildings and the resources as well. As you said, it depends on the play, and it also depends on your situation. I think even I, despite my reservations about the pyramids, stone, I will consider it. It's probably a 50-50, but if you also happen to be industrious, well, yeah, go for it. I mean, my gosh, even if you just end up with the frickin' gold from its investment, well worth it, even if you don't get it in that respect.
And, you know, this poster here brings up the early great engineer points, and that really is key, especially since they switched Great Wall around to a spy instead of engineer. Because you get an early great engineer, basically, you have another wonder of your choice.
And because of the power of that great engineer, I'm thankful in a way that the pyramids are as expensive as they are. You put in a fair bit of investment, and then if you're able to get that great engineer and then use that for another wonder, there's a return on your investment. You had to put a lot up front to get it, but you got the return. I can see that. When it comes to early wonders, I'd still rather Stonehenge or Great Wall or even the Oracle.
Getting to pick your government type early, universal suffrage, it's not really an advantage till later in the game, so that really you don't want. Police state, I never really use. I think it's too expensive for what you get out of it versus the other civics. But representation's a gem if you're running philosophical, especially early on in the game when there isn't a whole lot of beakers floating around anyway. They mean a lot more early in the game.
And although it's a little later on down the road when I think of beakers, I guess for me, I think more about bureaucracy in the sense that of having more gold and having more hammers, being able to run my science slider higher, and then having libraries in those cities as far as the beaker costs go.
It's always fun, though, when you're running around with pikemen and macemen and catapults and everyone else is just acquired axemen 10 turns earlier. Basically, you don't need a whole lot of production at that point. Just scare everyone off.
This is a vault segment with topics cut from earlier episodes, but I found relevance again later. From episode 49 with Dan Q, Makalua, Cardamandua, Oz, and Kale, followed by from episode 65 with Dan Q, Makalua, Imran Siddiqui, Provost Harrison, Vitlish, and Dojo Boy.
Dan, can we talk about my thread now, please?
Oh, what's the most vassals you've gotten on a single turn? Sure.
Brag about that.
You actually won for me.
Yeah.
Same here. I was like, whoa.
I was like, at the title, I'm like, you can get more than one in one turn? What?
Probably possible to do it. I may have done it before, but I just don't pay attention. I don't think it was that impressive or not. Like, if I'm winning a huge war, I might get two or three. But that's not something I brag. Ooh, I got two vassals. You know, I don't see the huge thing here.
It's kind of neat to be able to say I got more than one vassal on a single turn. I can see the advantage of having more than one vassal. If you'd like looking at your score, for example, that can help with your score. You know, someone likes that. But...
yeah, if you want to win the game, sure. Yeah, domination and stuff.
But more than one on a single turn, I'd never actually heard of that, but okay.
If you maybe make a colony civ at the same time you vassalize an enemy, maybe that's a way you could do it. If you understand. Like, you would build a colony, like, you would separate a part of your empire. At the same time, you would be in a war conquering somebody, and you would vassalize them at the same time you make your colony. Maybe that's a way you can get two vassals in a turn.
I honestly don't have that many vassals even in a game. That's pretty rare for me, so getting multiples in a turn is just unheard of for me. Nobody usually likes me, because I tend to be kind of underhanded in my dealings with other people. I believe strongly in manifest destiny, and I apply it whenever it meets my needs to claim land.
In the game, right?
Yeah, he just knocked down his neighbor's fence and...
I claim your yard.
I thought it was funny in this poll how four people voted for zero. I'm like, if you didn't ever had a vassal, why would you even bother to vote? Really? Really?
It's the same reason we all vote in polls. You can't see the responses unless you vote. At least it's not very easy to, so we all vote. Just like our blue glowing promotion guys. You gotta click on them.
IGN did a somewhat controversial list, which their top 100s always are, about the top 100 game designers of all time. They went through and listed from all sorts of different consoles, PCs, any games, not making it just one or the other. And a few familiar, as you can imagine, names were on this. For our focus, number 57 on the list was a guy named Bruce Shelley, who we should all know worked with old Sid with Microprose on Roto Tycoons, the first Civilization, you know, that little game. And then he went on to do Age of Empires and most recently Halo Wars. A little bit higher up the list, number 33 even, is Brian Reynolds, who helped with colonization, did a lot of the work on Civilization 2 and on Alpha Centauri, just did Rise of Nations and Catan. And, oh, of course, this other guy named Sid Meier. He was number 2. He did a few games. I don't know if you guys have heard of them.
They said that.
There's a Civilization game.
Nah. Number 1 should be fairly obvious. Shigeru Miyamoto. He's just done things like Super Mario Brothers, Legend of Zelda, Donkey Kong. You know, that sort of thing.
Yeah, nothing influential there.
No. Number 3 after Sid was Will Wright, who's, of course, known for the Sims series. So Sid, once again, places very high on this list, and deservedly so.
The one other person I recognized on the top 10 was John Carmack at number 10.
Mm-hmm.
You forgot Kojima from Metal Gear. He's number 6.
I know the game that these people might be behind. You say the game, I'm like, oh, but I don't know the name of the person. So I'm just going by name recognition.
The Final Fantasy guy, Hironobu Sakaguchi, was 4th. And of course, in the comments, there's a lot of bitching about that. Why is Sid Meier number 2? Yeah, Sakaguchi is far better.
Oh, the Metal Gear fans.
Yeah, the Metal Gear fans. Kojima is so much better.
He should be number 1. No, he should not. He hasn't been around long enough for that.
A Resident Evil people, yeah, Mikami should be number 2. Why is Sid Meier and Will Wright number 2 and 3? It's amazing to read these comments and see these people being like, why is Sid Meier up there at 2? That's ridiculous.
If you feel that strongly about it, make your own top 100 list, and then we'll bitch about yours. Okay.
I mean, not just that. It's just kind of funny to see people being like, Carmack at 10 while Sid Meier and Will Wright at number 2 and 3 is a joke. Well, I think Carmack is very influential. Some people just don't know the history of gaming that well.
Can we extend this to the top 11? Because for me, this list is incomplete without having Ultima in there.
No, that's true, Mr. Garrett. But of course, I will never forgive him for the last Ultima. Ultima 9.
Oh, Ascension.
That big, buggy piece of, you know what.
You mean the game where we should have stuck to 2D because 3D was still a little iffy?
Yeah, that one.
And then our game would have shipped on time and had a complete story and all that kind of fun. Yeah. Yay.
Knocked him down a little.
At number 23, even though the list says Roberta Williams, if you actually go to the page, it's Ken and Roberta for King's Quest. Not that I ultimately left on good terms with that series, but that's okay. That's something else entirely.
Yeah, I think a lot of people didn't leave on good terms on that series.
I'm still bitter.
As you said, any top 100 list, any top 10 list, any top anything list is going to result in controversy.
And of course, it depends on what time is it being done, because number 89 is Fergus Urquhart, the guy who did Fallout, Baldur's Gate, Planescape Torment, Icewind Dale. If this list was done in 2001, right after Icewind Dale, he'd probably be in the top 50.
If this had been done before Hellgate London, Bill Roper would be higher on the list.
There's a lot of things like that. But of course, one of the comments I read, how did Sid Meier and Will Wright jump over the Final Fantasy people? And I'm like, jump over? This list was done 15 years ago, 10 years ago. Sid Meier and Will Wright would still be 2 and 3.
Yeah.
So what you're arguing is not how did they jump over, but how did your guys not jump over them?
Mm-hmm. Because the stuff they worked on has been around almost as long as Civilization. Yeah, why aren't they past them?
The top 3 is easy. It's the same in every list, almost.
Yeah.
Be
seated in the theater where co-hosts share their gameplay experiences.
I have one, and it actually ties into what Gloria was talking about earlier, and she'll know what I'm going to talk about probably now that I've said that.
Mm-hmm. Go for it. Go for it.
Go for it.
Go for it.
All right, so Gloria and I had a multiplayer game, just she and I, and we were going up against the AI. I'm going to abbreviate the story a fair bit, but one of the AIs built the Apostolic Palace. Gloria converted to that religion. I was on my own continent, wiped out my AI, and was able to expand across the continent, although it was pretty small. That religion spread to me, and I was comparable in power to this other AI, and Gloria was farther behind in power, but she was playing the diplomacy very well with this other AI. They were friendly towards her. So I said to Gloria, well, you know, we could have this long-out battle where I'm taking this guy on, and, you know, you're helping as well from your front. I said, but let's go for the AP victory, seeing as how we'd had it enabled, even though I never thought for a minute that I'd be suggesting that. So I said, I'll spread Hinduism to my cities, you spread Hinduism to yours. We did that and came up for the election, and he put forth, he was the resident, and he put up the election for it. And what actually happened the first time is...
I voted for him, and you said, oh, the game is over.
Yeah, and then it turned out that all of a sudden, the next turn, it was like the election has been canceled. And I'm still not exactly sure about that. It was in the middle of a war with another AI that eventually got wiped out. So I was just like, wow, okay, that's good. I'm starting to build up and spread their religion in my civ. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to vote for you. I wasn't prepared to convert to that religion. My powerful was strong enough. He couldn't get to me anyways. He was across the water. Plus, I had my own religion, and it was spread everywhere, so I wasn't about to switch. So I think not once, not twice, not three times, but four times the vote came up, and we lost collectively, Gloria and I lost by 15 votes or less every single time.
No, we even built cities and put the religion in there. And what we discovered, I think, that works best. I only had 7 votes the first time that we had that come up. I didn't have very many buildings. I didn't have many cities with that religion. So we started spreading it as best we could. But the best up the ante was to build all the religious buildings pertaining to it. It got a little bit tricky when we got down to the latter era. I was afraid we weren't going to be able to build any more missionaries.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we've run out of room to settle. Played Tectonics Pangea, but that actually created 2 continents. I was off on my own. Gosh, that was freaking annoying. Tectonics seems to do that on Pangea. And poor Gloria was left with 2 AIs.
Well, I think we could eventually get it by building all the buildings in the cities we've put in, because that particular civ didn't have expansion room.
No, it didn't. So the game is saved. May return to it at some point. Calling today! In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY.
You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
You've been listening to episode 72. We've been joined by Christopher Pinchak.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I am proud to be a Civ player, proud to be an Apolyton member, and very proud to be on this Polycast. Bye-bye.
Gloria, or Condor 223.
Good night. Good afternoon. Goodbye.
Daniel Quick.
Are you playing Civ yet?
Imran Siddiqui.
Bye.
Makalua.
Bye.
And myself, Cardamandua. Bye.
Run my science slider higher, higher, higher. There we go, higher. And anyone else with recent gameplay experiences they would like to share? It doesn't have to be as long as mine.
Once we played a game and it was fun.
Just once.
Record date?
June 27th, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword, sound clips, copyright, Take Two Interactive.
Copyright 2009, Appolton Civilization site at appolton.net.